Lampstand Press presents Weft History Audio, original material written by Scott Somerville, edited and read aloud by Nate Somerville, with color commentary provided by me, Ted the Thread,
and special appearances by Christina Somerville as Nellie the Needle.
Year 4, Week 2, The Progressive Era. This week, we'll be talking about the things that happened during President Theodore Roosevelt's second term, beginning in 1905. And Howard Taft's one term in office, which ended in 1913. Your reading this week should be about the devastating earthquake that occurred in 1906 in San Francisco, the sinking of the mighty Titanic, the building of the Panama Canal, and the reforms of Jane Addams, the first American woman to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes, I'm noble. I'm the king of the radical revolutionary surfer dudes, and I'm still in one piece, so therefore, I get a prize. Woohoo!
Ted, we covered this last week. Alfred Nobel left his fortune to be handed out as prizes to people and scientists who made the most important discoveries in science and did the most to help people around the world.
Ha! You're just jealous because I'm more handsome than you are.
Actually, the Nobel Prize was one of the first global organizations. Global means worldwide. It wasn't an American or British or German or French prize. It was a prize for anyone around the world.
Yeah, but what's so great about that?
It wasn't necessarily better, but it was different. At that time, nationalism was a very strong idea. Nationalism, which means loving your own country the best, often led to people hating people from other countries. The Nobel Prize, in a sense, was an example of globalism, which is an idea whose goal is for there to be one world government over all the nations.
This seems like something Nellie would like. If there was one government, then no one would want to fight each other. Me, I've got a bazooka and a flamethrower that are itching to be used.
There will most certainly be one world government someday, when Jesus returns and rules as king. But until that day, the efforts of globalism repeat the pride of the Tower of Babel and ignore the wickedness of men. God has deliberately divided mankind by languages and tribes and families.
Hey, wait a second. I thought we were supposed to love everybody. You know, red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. Even girls? I'm not saying it's easy, but because Nellie is a girl, I do have to try to love her.
Yep, you're right, Ted. We Christians, in the context of the church, have already chosen to follow Jesus as our Savior and King. What we have is a foretaste, like the preview for a trailer of a new movie, of what is coming, the Kingdom of Heaven. The biggest problem with globalism is that it tries to make a perfect kingdom on earth without God. Globalists want there to be peace and love and harmony, but they reject Jesus, who is the way, the truth, and the life. Without Jesus and the power of the Holy Spirit to love each other, our sinful hearts will always lead us into wickedness.
Yeah, that's a bummer. Hey, do you think it would be loving if I shared my worm collection with Nellie by leaving it in her sock drawer?
No, definitely not. Okay, if you have any older brothers and sisters, they will be learning about the war between Russia and Japan. They'll also be learning about the discoveries of Albert Einstein, the theories of Sigmund Freud, and the start of Hollywood motion pictures, which are movies. Overall, even though they weren't aware of it, Europe was rushing towards the ruin and bloodshed of World War I. All the seeds of destruction had been sown and were growing, and were now almost ready for that dreadful harvest. These years in Europe before World War I are often called the Age of Innocence. Americans and Europeans alike were optimistic about the future. People saw the rapid advances in science, industry, and government, and felt like mankind stood on the cusp of solving all of its problems and realizing all of its dreams for the future. One meaning of innocent is childlike or naive. What Europeans did not realize was how these advances in science, industry, and government would have an effect on the age-old art of war. In hindsight, the Europeans, with their vast buildup of arms and their assumptions that all future wars would be short and relatively bloodless, despite their new powerful weapons, were incredibly naive. And for Christians, it was anything but a time of innocence. These years were a time of astonishing apostasy and pride.
Apostasy? Yes, it's about time. I was getting hungry with all this boring learning stuff. I mean, they say that time flies when you're having fun, But when you take away my bazooka and my chainsaw, you won't even let me wrestle with a Sasquatch or two. I've got to ask, are we really having any fun? So, bring on the lasagna, the ravioli, the tortellini, and the spaghetti.
Pasta? Why are you talking about pasta?
Well, you're the one that brought it up. Although, frankly, your grammar was a little weird. Ah, pasta si. You were saying that you see pasta, and I'm hungry. So let's eat. Pass me the Parmesan cheese, please.
Ted, apostasy has nothing to do with spaghetti.
Aw, man, you're killing me here. I'm starving away to nothing. Pretty soon, I'm going to be skinnier than dental floss. All right, fine. Tell me what apostasy means.
Apostasy means people who once believed in Jesus, but have now turned their backs on him. They were once Christians, but have chosen to stop believing in the Bible, and now reject the truth of the gospel. They would rather believe in the world's wisdom than in God's.
Well, that's not a good thing.
The countries of Europe that had once been full of churches and people who loved God had largely turned their backs on Jesus. Instead of learning from the civil wars, the revolutions, and the struggles with racism and slavery in both North and South America, Europeans plunged headlong in their rejection of and rebellion against God. It wasn't innocence that fueled what became known as Europe's climate of hate, which led nationalistic countries to bluster and bully one another. Such trash talk led to an arms race across Europe, plus an ever more complex web of international alliances between nations.
An arms race? Yes! I love racing! How are we going to do this? Do we race while doing a handstand all the way? Do we have those funny bikes that you pedal with your hands instead of your feet? Do we see who can have the most massive, manly bicep the fastest? What are we talking about here? Whatever it is, I'm ready for it.
The word arms is often used to refer to weapons of war. So an arms race is one where each country tries to create newer, better, and more deadly weapons.
Ah, this is so cool. Tell me more.
We could spend hours on this. But the point is that each country in an arms race keeps building bigger or better weapons. If the first country builds a ship with 2 masts and 20 cannons on a single deck, then the second country might build a ship with 3 masts and 30 cannons on 2 decks. Then the first country would build a ship with 3 masts and 48 cannons on 2 decks. So the second country would then build a ship with 3 masts, 3 decks, and 80 cannons.
Yeah, this is great stuff. How do you spell cannon fodder?
Ted, are you actually taking notes?
Well, of course I am. This is the best thing that you've done all year.
So whether it was planes or guns or bullets or bombs, artillery, ships, tanks, or anything else, an arms race means that 2 or more countries are putting a lot of energy into inventing better ways to kill each other.
Well, I love explosions and all that, but actually killing people? That's sort of a problem.
That's one of the big problems with an arms race. You've got all these weapons, and there's a strong temptation to use them. You spend so much time thinking about how to kill people that you forget to try and make peace with them instead. With nearly every country armed to the teeth, and angry with 1 or more countries, the situation in Europe was building up into the sort of bomb that could explode at any time. And when it did, in 1914, it turned into the bloodiest war that the planet had seen yet. Leaving Europe to its illusions for now, let's start this week's overview with Teddy Roosevelt. His first term as president began when William McKinley was shot, but Teddy didn't think reaching the presidency that way really counted. What he wanted more than anything was to be elected president in his own right. The Republicans all picked Teddy for re-election in 1904. He won the election by more than 2.5 million votes, more than any president before him. As we talked about last week, Teddy Roosevelt loved the outdoors. His love wasn't a selfish love. He wanted to share all the wonderful things he'd experienced with his fellow Americans. Through his efforts, he launched America's system of national parks. He signed laws that created 5 national parks, and he proclaimed 4 more national monuments by executive authority.
Monument? Is that where you ask your mom if she really meant it when she tells you to take a bath?
No. A monument is a marker of sorts to help us always remember some important person or event.
Like the Statue of Liberty in New York City. It reminds us of our freedom and how America welcomes immigrants from other countries.
Wait. Are you going to make a monument of me? It should be 50 feet high. In one hand, I'll have a bazooka. And in the other, I'll have a slice of space pizza. You can put the radical revolutionary surfer dude crown on my head. And under my feet, I want there to be a dozen or so Yetis, Sasquatches, and Bigfeets, and a Swamp Thing, to show how strong I am.
Uh-huh. That is not going to happen, Ted. We're not going to make a monument of you. But they did make a monument of Teddy Roosevelt. His face is carved in stone at one of America's most recognizable national monuments, Mount Rushmore, which he shares with George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. Roosevelt read many different books. He wrote several of his own books, and he was a believer in the theories of the day, social Darwinism among them.
Wait, what is social Darwinism? Is that where the dwarves and the hobbit all get together and drink tea and talk about their beards and their axes behind each other's backs?
That would be social dwarves, and I suspect that they would be drinking something stronger than tea. Social Darwinism takes the idea of natural selection, that the strongest and best will survive and have kids, and uses it with people groups and politics. It's the idea that the strongest country will and should survive, and that weaker countries will die out and be taken over by the stronger countries.
First I was afraid. I was petrified. Kept thinking that I could never live without a bazooka by my side. But then I spent so many nights making my flamethrower strong, so I'm not wrong, and I know how to get along. Oh no, not I. I will survive.
Okay, that was a very interesting song.
Oh, thank you. This is just a little something I threw together.
As a progressive, Roosevelt believed in the power of government to help make people's lives better. Throughout his career, when he saw a problem and had power to do something about it, he was fearless in going after it. For example, after reading The Jungle, Upton Sinclair's book about the meatpacking industry, Roosevelt brought the power of government to bear on the issue. His new food and drink agency made it the nation's responsibility to ensure the purity of what Americans ate or drank.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. Wee-ay-oh-ay-a-bum-ba-way.
Ted?
Yes?
Not now.
Oh, okay.
No more singing.
All right.
Roosevelt's aggressiveness was on full display diplomatically in his second term. There were some people who accused Roosevelt of being a warmonger with his big stick policies and intense patriotism. But his big stick seemed to make peace, not break it. When Russia and Japan went to war over some contested islands in 1904, Roosevelt refused to take sides. Instead, he hosted a peace conference for the two nations in New Hampshire in 1905. Although both nations were difficult to work with, Roosevelt's patience led to a compromise being reached in the Treaty of Portsmouth. As a result of his peacemaking, Roosevelt was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace the next year, the first American to win that prize. Japan wasn't happy with the United States, however. America had acquired significant possessions in the Pacific after the Spanish-American War, but Japan didn't like America's presence in places like Guam and the Philippines. Racism was still running strong in America, and Japanese Americans were often treated badly. When the San Francisco public schools started segregating Japanese children from the rest of the students, war with Japan seemed imminent. But President Roosevelt wasn't looking for war, so he pressured the San Francisco school board to stop discriminating against Japanese children.
Discriminate? Is that what happens when the detective walks into the room that they use for questioning and sees that the guy handcuffed to the table has eaten all the donuts?
No. Why would you think that?
Well, this criminal ate. And what would a criminal eat except for donuts? I mean, when you get arrested, they frisk you for snacks and weapons. I can't tell you how many granola bars I've lost that way.
Discriminate means to choose between things that are different. Usually it means to choose the good one out from the bad. In the good sense of the word, someone who discriminates knows how to pick the best food or art or friends or whatever. But in the bad sense of the word, discriminate means that we act against something, even if it is good, just because we don't like it.
So if I don't like girls and I keep Nellie out of my room because she's a girl,
that would be the bad kind of discrimination. People are often discriminated because of their race, their color, whether or not they're men or women, or how they live their lives. Throughout history, many Christians have been discriminated against because we follow Jesus.
So, did the lions discriminate
when the Christians were fed to them in Roman times? I'm pretty sure that lions don't discriminate. They just happily eat anyone that gets thrown to them. Part of the problem with discrimination is that it isn't fair, especially when a government, which is supposed to treat everyone equally, starts doing it. After dealing with the San Francisco School Board, Roosevelt negotiated a gentleman's agreement that got Japan to voluntarily reduce immigration and signed a treaty to reduce tensions with Japan. In 1907, Roosevelt sent a fleet of new American battleships around the world on a 2-year tour of friendship. He wanted not only to show off America's strength, but also to deliver a message of peace to those who saw it. The Great White Fleet's tour was a success, and Roosevelt was again praised for his peacemaking attempts. As we noted last week, Roosevelt had negotiated an agreement with Colombia for land across the Isthmus of Panama for a canal.
Wait a second. What does negotiate mean? Is that what you tell your mom when she calls your sister or cousin to come and eat lunch, but she's still full from eating snacks?
No. Why would you think that?
Listen carefully. Ne, which obviously means no or won't. Go, she ate. Negotiate.
That actually makes more sense than usual for you, Ted. But negotiate means to try and come to an agreement, to talk things through until both sides agree.
Yeah, I think I like absolute monarchy better.
Well, only if you're the absolute monarch. Suppose that I said it's time for bed.
Well, then I'd say you're in a state of denial.
Yeah, you would say that. But imagine that we talked it through. You might ask to stay up for another hour, and then I would say that if you did your homework reading, you could stay up. And then you might offer to practice reading aloud, which is like homework, but you want to read the latest Wings of Fire book because you love dragons. And then I would agree, but only for half an hour.
So, we're going to be reading about dragons now?
No, that was just an example. But the point is that we started with you wanting an hour of extra time, and I wanted you to do your homework. By negotiating, we talked to each other until we could agree on a middle path, where each of us got something that we wanted.
Can I have cookies and milk?
We'll negotiate about that later. When Roosevelt was negotiating with the Colombians, they wanted more money and tried to back out of their agreement. So then Roosevelt sent support to the rebels, who declared their independence from Colombia and formed the Republic of Panama, which promptly handed over the canal zone to the American engineers. The Panama Canal was a triumph of engineering and of medicine. Digging the canal wasn't all that hard. It was staying alive in the disease-infested jungles that was the problem. Yellow fever and malaria killed men faster than they could dig, and rats carried the bubonic plague.
Ah, these Panamanians are so cool. They've got yellow fever, malaria, jungle rats, and the bubonic plague. All I get is the flu and the sniffles.
You do realize that these diseases kill people, right? And not just a few here or there, Ted, but lots of them. Healthy men who would have lived for many more years if they hadn't gone to Panama.
Sure, but everybody dies. I mean, at least these guys got to die while battling jungle rats, playing with dynamite and heavy earth-moving equipment, and from a cool-sounding disease like bubonic plague. Ah, what a way to go.
Well, the workers decided that they would rather live if they could, which I know sounds boring to you. In 1904, an American army surgeon, Colonel William Gorgas, was sent to deal with the problem. Gorgas had contracted yellow fever himself in the 1880s, but learned how to beat it and other mosquito-borne tropical diseases in Cuba after the Spanish-American War. Gorgas started by draining the swamps and clearing the brush near the canal. Taking away the water in the underbrush left the mosquitoes with no place to breed. His efforts worked. As the danger of tropical diseases went down, the real digging could begin. It was a huge project motivated by an equally huge vision. The canal motto was, "The land divided, the world united." The workers had to move more than 200 million cubic yards of rock and soil to construct the canal. From when they started in 1904 until 1914, when the first ship sailed through, it took 10 years of hard labor to get the first parts of the canal built. After his re-election in 1904, Roosevelt told the country that under no circumstances would he run for president for a third term. He chose his Secretary of War, William H. Taft, to succeed him. Taft had been a very intelligent student. Second in his high school class, he graduated from Yale University in 1874 and went on to study at the University of Cincinnati Law School. He became a lawyer in Ohio in 1880 and soon became an assistant prosecutor. After working in a private law practice, Taft desired to become a judge. He fulfilled this ambition when he became a judge of the Ohio Superior Court in 1887. President Benjamin Harrison appointed Taft to be the United States Solicitor General in 1890. 2 years later, Taft became a judge on the 6th U.S. Circuit Court, where he eventually became the Chief Justice. During this time, he also taught law. In 1900, President McKinley appointed Taft to be Commissioner of the Philippines.
The Philistines? I thought David took care of them a long time ago.
Oh no, Ted. The Philistines were the ancient enemies of Israel back in Bible times. The Philippines was a group of islands in the Pacific Ocean that was discovered by European explorers. I think my book said 1543, and the Philippines Islands were named in honor of King Philip II of Spain. I learned a lot of stuff from my book this week.
Look, I know that David used a sling to take out Goliath, but I'm pretty sure that's just because bazookas hadn't been invented yet. I've heard that they have giant statues on Easter Island. If they come alive and are attached to even bigger statue bodies, and then they start rampaging through the downtown streets of helpless Filipino cities, can I use my bazooka, or do I have to use a sling?
If giant stone statues start rampaging and running amok through the downtown streets of helpless Filipino towns and cities, then yes, you may use a bazooka.
Ah, yes, this is going to be awesome.
Taft later became Governor General of the Philippine Islands. He worked hard and skillfully to bring peace to the Philippines, to create a civil government on the island, and to promote the development of self-government there, even though he didn't much care to work in the executive branch of government. Taft's heart still belonged to the law, to judges and courts. From 1904 to 1908, Taft served as the Secretary of War for President Roosevelt. He helped establish the American Protectorate in Cuba after the Spanish-American War. His legal skills and success at governing these U.S. territories led Roosevelt to suggest him as his successor. Taft was fairly happy with his life as a minister in the United States government, but his wife was not. She really wanted to be the First Lady, the wife of the president. So Taft accepted the nomination. He was able to beat the Democratic nominee, William Jennings Bryan, a man we've seen before and we'll see again. Roosevelt packed his bags and went off to Africa on safari.
Safari? Is that a kind of race car? Like a Ferrari? Will you let me drive?
No.
Can I at least honk the horn and stick my head out the window and yell at people in Italian? Pasta! Spaghetti! Rigatoni!
No, Ted, that would be rude. A safari is a journey in Africa. It comes from the Arabic and Swahili words safar and safari, which mean journey. After a while, Europeans on safari started to add in hunting as a part of the experience. They would try to shoot lions, leopards, rhinos, elephants, and Cape buffalo.
But do you have to shoot those beautiful animals if you go on safari, Mr. Nate?
No. Today, some people still like to hunt on safari, but most people just use cameras to take pictures instead.
So, wait a second. Roosevelt got to go on vacation to Africa and hunt lions and elephants and rhinos? Does every president get to do this? Because that is pretty cool. I might just have to become president so that I can go on safari afterwards. Just wait till those Cape buffalo meet my bazooka.
Well, not every president goes on safari, Ted. But if you have enough money, even an ordinary person can go. It is an amazing experience. Although, I think that you should leave your bazooka at home.
Well, I don't have to be president to go.
No, frankly, I think that it would be best for everyone if you were never president.
Wait. Who is this Frank guy? And why do we care what he thinks?
When Roosevelt went on safari, the more conservative Republicans were so glad to see him go that some of them openly wished that the lions would have good luck hunting him. Howard Taft was a brilliant legal scholar and a dedicated public servant with a lot of practical experience. But even with all that, he wasn't really ready for the rough and tumble world of the American presidency. Unfortunately, Taft's legal skills and experience in governing conquered islands did not prepare him for the political challenges on the national level. He wasn't as progressive as Roosevelt, nor as conservative as McKinley. He kept trying to steer a middle course on various issues. which wound up alienating everybody.
Oh, wait a second. This guy is my hero. He turned everybody into aliens? That is so cool. Do they have green skin and glowing eyes? Did they grow tentacles? Were they able to use the Force? Wait, does this mean we could build a Death Star?
No, Ted. First of all, the people who built the Death Star were humans, remember? Second, President Taft didn't turn anyone into an alien. He alienated them.
Yeah. What's the difference?
To alienate someone is to make them your enemy. Alien means stranger or outsider. It means someone that comes from another country.
Well, wait a second. What about space aliens?
Well, they definitely would be from another country. In fact, they'd be from another planet, which would mean that they're not even human. But there are plenty of aliens right here on Earth. If you were to travel to another country, you would be an alien, once you were there.
I get to be a space alien? Yes! Ha ha! Hey, if I deliver pizza in another country, that means I get to be a space alien pizza delivery guy.
Well, no, because you're not from outer space. You're not even from another world. You're from this world. But you could be an alien pizza delivery threat if you'd like.
All right, fine. I'll take what I can get. Meanwhile, I'm going to go work on my plans for the Death Melon.
The Death Melon?
Yeah, it's a giant watermelon-shaped battle station, and it will be 10 times more amazing than that silly old Death Star.
Okay. Well, while Ted is off doing that, we're going to keep talking about President Taft. Instead of building a group of political allies to help him advance his goals, he disappointed both wings of his own political party without winning any new support from anyone. And that left him largely ineffective as a president. When Roosevelt came back from Africa, the progressive Republicans started urging him to run again in 1912. He finally decided to break his no third term promise and run, but not as a Republican. He formed his own progressive party, better known as the Bull Moose Party, and tried to defeat both Taft and the Democratic nominee. 3 weeks before the election, Roosevelt was hit by an assassin's bullet just before a campaign stop in Milwaukee. He wasn't killed. The bullet was slowed down by the glasses case in his pocket.
Wow, those are some tough glasses. I'm surprised that he didn't start selling them to all the geeks who get beat up in school by bullies. These glasses are tough enough to stop bullets. Imagine what they'll do to a bully's fist. That would be his slogan.
Yeah, you might have a future in marketing, Ted. That is a pretty good idea. Although it's probably the case that the glasses were in more than the glasses themselves that saved Roosevelt's life.
Yeah. Don't bother me with trifling details. Now, what do you think are the chances that I can get X-ray vision built into these glasses so that I can see which Pokemon cards are inside of those packs? You see, I've already gotten 19 Pikachus, and I really want a Charmeleon or a Lucario in my next pack.
Yeah, I'd have to say that your chances of X-ray vision are slim to none. Even though Teddy Roosevelt had been shot, he refused to cancel his speech for a little thing like a bullet in the chest. So he gave the speech anyways. Assassinations are less predictable than American politics. Roosevelt's third party run split the Republican vote and handed the election to the Democrats. New Jersey Governor Woodrow Wilson won the election of 1912. In 1906, San Francisco was the third largest city in the United States, until a massive earthquake hit it at 5 a.m. one day. The earthquake ruptured gas pipes, which ignited fires that burned out of control for the next 4 days and nights. Nearly two-thirds of the city's 400,000 residents were left homeless by the quake and the fires, and thousands were still living in tents 2 years later. The government would not admit how many people died at the time of the earthquake because they were afraid that people back east would not want to move out to California. Today, scholars think that as many as 3,000 people died during the earthquake. Although only half as many people died aboard the unsinkable Titanic when it steamed into an iceberg in 1912, that disaster was all the more terrible because it could have been easily avoided. The story of the Titanic is a tale that combines human hubris, which is a word for deadly pride, with true heroism. Convinced that they had built the ultimate ship, so large and strong and tough that nothing could sink it, the captain of the Titanic wasn't careful when he was given reports of icebergs in the area. Most ships knew that if they hit an iceberg, they were in serious trouble. Sadly for the Titanic, God's icebergs proved stronger than mankind's ship.
This is a terrible story.
In many ways, it is. But there were good things that happened as a result of this tragedy.
Like what?
Well, for one thing, people stopped being so proud about how big and strong they could build ships. God humbled the proud and showed them that he was stronger than their best efforts. In addition to this, people realized that having enough lifeboats was a very important thing. And that has doubtless saved hundreds of other lives over the years.
Well, that does help a little.
And furthermore, ship owners have agreed that they should learn how to use technology better, such as radios at that time, but nowadays they also use satellite GPS and other inventions, so that in the case of a disaster, nearby ships would know where the wreck happened, and they would hopefully be able to help pick up survivors.
Oh, well, that's definitely a good thing.
Yes. If those three things, lifeboats for everyone, radio contact, and known positions, had been present during the wreck of the Titanic, far fewer people would have died. Well, since the builders of the ship did not believe that the Titanic could be sunk, there were not enough lifeboats for all the passengers on board the ship. Acting like heroes, many men and boys gave up their places on overcrowded lifeboats so that women and younger children could live. Anyone not in a lifeboat had to swim for as long as they could until they drowned in the icy water. These brave passengers showed the kind of love that Jesus has for us, since they were willing to give up their lives to save others, even those who were complete strangers. In the end, the mighty Titanic broke in half and then sank to the bottom of the ocean, where it was lost for 73 years, until an expedition in 1985 finally managed to find the wreck. So that wraps up this week's whirlwind tour of what happened during two Republican administrations. After he left office, President Taft wound up becoming the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He's the only person yet to lead both the executive and the judicial branches of the federal government. Teddy Roosevelt went off to explore the Amazonian rainforest in 1914, and he was thinking about running for president again in 1920. But he died of a blood clot in his heart in 1919 at the age of 60. Who knows what might have happened if he'd live? Meanwhile, America and Europe were enjoying the last few years of peace before World War I broke out. But we will wait to talk about that until next week.